you're not there, because we feel so good.
Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome John Neff, who recently retired from a very long, productive, and fascinating career in music and recording. John started playing guitar at the age of 10 while growing up in Pontiac, Michigan. He formed the Ascots at 14, writing and recording the garage rock classic So Good, and opening for groups like the Turtles, the Who, Shades of Blue, and the Capitals. Two more bands followed, The Tribe and Toad and the Mushroom, before John got a steady job playing guitar in Motown and Stax producer Don Davis's house band, backing some very big names such as Curtis Mayfield, Isaac Hayes, Mary Wells, The Spinners, and Billy Paul. From there, he played bass guitar for Steppenwolf in the late 70s, then with Hoyt Axton and Red Eye. In 1979, John quit the music business for the time being, married, and moved to Maui. He was asked to DJ at a local radio station, and that turned into a popular and long-running morning show. John was there for the birth of Jawaian music, a mix of Jamaican reggae, Hawaiian pop, and a touch of Motown soul. While living on Maui, John met Steely Dan's Walter Becker and partnered with him to build a recording studio. There he worked as audio engineer on Becker's solo album, 11 Tracks of Whack, and again on Donald Fagen's Kamakiriad. After a stint in Phoenix, running his own recording studio, John moved to Los Angeles and collaborated with filmmaker David Lynch on the sound design and audio engineering for The Straight Story, Mulholland Drive, and Inland Empire. He also did the sound mix for DVD releases of Lynch's Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, and Eraserhead. From L.A., John moved to Portland to be closer to family, and here he built and ran a sound studio called The Lab. John retired, or so he claims, just a few months ago, but music's in his blood, and he continues to take on a few production gigs while also playing bass in the Portland band Christy Joseph and The Purpose. Please join us for our conversation with John Neff, which is already in progress. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, John, you've had a long, productive, and fascinating career, and there's so much we can talk about. I've been reading about it for the last few days, so I thought we'd hit a few highlights, though there are many. First, as a middle school kid growing up in Pontiac, Michigan, just outside of Detroit in the early 60s, and you're living almost every school kid's dream. You get a guitar, join a band called the Ascots, write and record a song with the title So Good, and get a big break while playing a high school sock hop. And I don't think they have sock hops anymore, but that was a big night for you. How did it help make the band? Can you describe that night?
Well, we were playing Notre Dame High School in Detroit, and the sock hop had about 2,000 kids.
Wow.
WXYZ AM, that's the ABC affiliate in Detroit, had a DJ kiosk set up on the dance floor and was spinning records. I gave him mine. And I just said, it was us, the Capitals, Cool Jerk, and the Shades of Blue, Oh How Happy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, how happy you have made me. And Cool Jerk. Come on, people. Oh, I love those songs. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was April of 66. And he played the record for the dance crowd. We thought Who Will It Be was the A side, but everybody played my side.
And that's the side you wrote. And then your bandmate wrote Who Will It Be?
Yes. So he played my song and the kids got up and danced. And then we played. And we played both sides of the record live. And then he took the record back to the radio station and started playing it. I had it in a number of local record stores. It sold out. And it just started to take off on radio.
And that's the way music used to break. You know, people listen to the radio. Now it's, you know, all these streaming services. There's really no one way to get your music anymore and break a record, really.
Yes, it's very difficult today.
Now you started the Ascots in 1963 when the Beatles started breaking big in the British Invasion. But you said the Beatles weren't your main influence. It was more the Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, the Animals, the Kingsmen, maybe early rockers like Chuck Berry.
Yes, exactly. Every one of those artists.
Why not the Beatles? They were a little too tame. I should describe so good, actually. When I first listened to it, it sounded, you know, it's a rough kind of garage band sound. I kind of, when I talked to you, I compared it to something like the Seeds, like Pushing Too Hard.
Yeah, it's a garage band cult classic today.
Yes, in fact, I looked it up on Discogs, the website for people who are selling records, and the 45 is going for about $600. It must be very rare.
A new unplayed one goes for $1,000.
Wow. Do you still have any? I'm just curious about that.
I have 6 or 7.
Well, there's the retirement fund.
Well, my guitars were the retirement fund.
I'm going to get to that a little later because I know you bought one recently that I want to talk about. So back to the Ascots. Now, this was the Detroit music scene. The Ascots were part of that. And when we first talked, you know, we were kind of testing out the audio here. You told me about hanging out with future stars like Bob Seger, Ted Nugent, the MC5. I think even Alice Cooper lived in Detroit before he moved to Phoenix. You were all about the same age and with the same rock ambitions. It seemed like this incredible kind of lush, fruitful time to be a rock musician.
It was, and all of us were trying to get records out. In 1964, Bob Seger and I were both trying to get a record out, and Bob got out East Side Story, and it's a wonderful little record, and he beat me to it, and then I had the Ascots the year later.
Now, you went to high school with Bob Seger?
No, he was a couple years older than me.
Oh, okay.
He went to, I'm not sure where he went. We had the same manager, Punch Andrews.
Now, what was that scene like? Did you guys, well, of course, you were like 14 or 15, so I don't think you were going to bars and all that, but were there hangouts, clubs, other sock hops, high school dances that you guys all got together at?
Yeah, we played high school dances every weekend. And I played with the Ascots. I played the local VFW Hall and Eagles Club. And they did sell booze to their members. And we played current hits and original music. We had a great drummer, Frank Giglio. He was 2 years older than the rest of us. It's his birthday today. He just turned 73.
Where's he now?
He's in Northern Michigan. And I saw him in 2015. We had a 50th anniversary reunion of the Ascots.
Oh, who was the rhythm guitar player? I actually read an interview with him, and he talked about that reunion.
Dale Kath, K-A-T-H.
That's it. And he wasn't related to Terry Kath, the Chicago.
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was trying to look that up on the internet, but he gave a great interview and talked quite a bit about you and enjoyed seeing you guys all at the Ascot reunion. Now, some of the questions I got from that and some from your previous interviews, but you must have incredible memories of those early days and the groups you played with. You opened for the Turtles, the Ascots did, at the Cobo Arena in Detroit, which is huge. I think that's where they played. The Detroit Red Wings played there, hockey?
No, the Cobo Arena was a specific acoustic hall.
Oh, it wasn't sports. It was music. Okay. And that was 66. And the one I have to ask you about, you opened for The Who, Keith Moon's 21st birthday. So that must have been August 67. You said in an interview, quote, "It was a memorable night." I would think, to say the least, it was a memorable night. What do you remember about that evening?
We drove on the DJ Caravan. We were taken in limousines from Windsor, Ontario to Flint, Michigan, to the Atwood Stadium. And Keith Moon, I was in the same car as Keith Moon.
Wow.
He was drinking out of a 1.75 liter bottle of vodka.
So even at the ripe old age of 21, he was into alcohol, probably before that, growing up in England.
Yeah, he was very seriously into alcohol.
And what was he like? Was he a lot of fun? Was he?
He was a ball. It was so much fun. His birthday cake, they brought it out. It was a big sheet cake. And he looked at it, growled, and went, boom.
That seems to jive with all the Keith Moon stories I've heard.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy, I mean, besides the fun part, did he seem like a kind of a nice guy? I mean, he wasn't snooty or anything like that. Well, the Who were very young, but I think they had that was Happy Jack, so they had at least one big hit at the time.
Yes, they had My Generation was out and The Kids Are All Right was out. Happy Jack was their third or fourth single. It's a great album, that album.
Did you also get to meet the other guys, Pete Townsend?
Oh, yes.
Daltrey, of course, and John Entwistle?
Yeah, Daltrey was a little distant. The rest of them were very friendly, and I remained friends with John. We had about a 35-year period where we didn't see each other, but we ran into each other at the NAMM show in Anaheim, California in the 90s and struck up our friendship again.
Now, you were a guitarist for the Ascots, but later on you took up the bass. Did you get any kind of tips from John Entwistle, either him teaching you or you just picking things up as you watched him?
Oh, I just watched him, but I could never play like that. He was one of a kind. He was a virtuoso. And he and Keith laid down this incredible rhythm that Pete was allowed to dance over. And Pete's guitar playing was completely floated above the band. It was an amazing thing to see in those early days.
We mentioned that first 45, So Good, is going for, well, you said in mint condition, about $1,000 now. And that was produced and mastered by your older brother, Tom Neff.
Yeah.
What did Tom do for the record? You guys recorded it, and he was the one that kind of got it ready for release on a 45?
Yes. We had a recording engineer, and Tom was the producer, and he set us up. He had been a hobbyist and recorded jazz bands and dance bands with a 3M portable tape recorder, so he was real familiar with the process. So he sort of guided us to be able to play in the studio and still get a band sound.
Is that where you first picked up audio engineering and production from your brother, John?
Yes, and the engineer for my next record, who took me under his wing and taught me a lot about the studio.
Yeah, and that became a big part of your later career. Not only were you a great musician, but incredible sound engineer in building these studios. Now, we'll get to that, but you played in two bands after the Ascots, I read, The Tribe, and then a group called Toad and the Mushroom, which is a very psychedelic name, but you've described them as more as an experimental band. And you mentioned even they were doing, I think even before Alice Cooper and certainly before Kiss, you were doing costumes and pyrotechnics?
Yes, that's all true.
Wow, how'd you get into that on the budget of kind of, a small band at the time?
Well, I was in theater. I acted for 9 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I also did special effects for theater, like I made it rain on the stage for Pygmalion, things like that. So I made my own effects. I made my own strobe light. I used a couple of Christmas color wheels and white sheets behind the band so that we'd get these different dancing colored shadows. And then I used double F grade gunpowder in a light socket for the pyrotechnics, and it would emit a ball of flame and a mushroom cloud that would go up about 6 or 8 feet.
Was that the mushroom in Toad and the Mushroom?
It was to me, but the Toad and the Mushroom was actually, the Toad was a 1948 English Austin van that we drove the equipment around in, and the mushroom was a paper mache and chicken wire mushroom that we used to carry around as a prop.
And I read also that even before The Who, Tommy, you did a rock opera with Toad and the Mushroom. You wrote one?
Yes.
What happened to that?
Well, we never recorded it. Ah. We wrote the Symphony Number 1 in D major for bass and guitar, and we did record that. But the opera, we never recorded. We did a basement tape of it while we were writing it, but we never finished it.
Now, I know we asked about your early influences in rock. Certainly, Chuck Berry, guys like that, and the Animals, Beach Boys. But you also have somewhat of a classical background. I've read that some of your favorite composers are like Aaron Copland, George Gershwin. So that's an interesting mix that you brought to your own music.
Yes, my mother raised me on classical music. We used to go to the Detroit Symphony and to the Broadway shows, the touring Broadway shows. The Sound of Music in 1961 changed my life when I realized those kids were getting paid.
Oh, to sing and dance on stage?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. No, that's incredible. And Detroit, you would get the New York shows, like what was the My Fair Lady, Sound of Music, you mentioned, maybe Fiddler on the Roof. Boy, that was kind of a West Side Story, a golden era.
Yeah. All the Oscar and Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff.
Now, how did you go from there, a Toad and the Mushroom and the pyrotechnics, to your next phase? I read you worked at United Sound in Detroit, and there was an ex-Motown producer, and he also worked at Stax Records, but then went out on his own, called Don Davis. He hired you as a session guitarist for some very big names. I was amazed. Curtis Mayfield, Isaac Hayes, Mary Wells, The Spinners, who I love, Billy Paul, you know, my last name, me and Mrs. Jones. I got that a lot in high school.
Yeah, I played on that.
Oh, you did? Did you play? You played,
I played guitar on that.
Oh, amazing. And you made over 175 soul records in a period of about 2-3 years.
I have to say it was closer to 150.
That's still a lot.
In retrospect, I overestimated it.
But it's still a lot. So what was that like being in the studio? Did you have a lot of leeway, or was the artist and maybe Don Davis kind of directing the orchestra? And I think it was he had a six-piece house band.
Yeah, I was the only white guy in a six-piece house band. We would record the rhythm tracks for people's records. We didn't record like the strings and horns and background vocals and things like that, strictly the band. And sometimes, like I can see clearly now, the tracks were shipped off to New York to be finished.
Oh, did Johnny Nash? You did that? Wow.
Yeah.
And so you were kind of like Don Davis's Steve Cropper.
In a way. Don had a house band at Motown. He had a house band at Stax. And when he bought United Sound Systems in Detroit, which was the oldest independent studio in the country, he formed his own house band there, because that way you can predict what your rhythm tracks are going to sound like. You can predict what your records are going to sound like.
Oh, yeah. Motown had their sound. Stax had the sound. Was his house band at Motown, were they the Funk Brothers?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So one of the best backing bands in recording history.
Yeah. And Stax was too.
Incredible records coming out. And then the ones you did for him. I just couldn't believe all the artists. And I didn't know the Me and Mrs. Jones and I Can See Clearly Now. Those are classics. Now, you went from there, so making these records, to joining, and this is one of my favorite parts, you joined Steppenwolf. In 1977, you switched from guitar, or rhythm or lead, to bass guitar. And you told me that was after their golden era, but still it's Steppenwolf. Songs like Born to Be Wild, Magic Carpet Ride, they never really go away. What were those tours like?
It was really wonderful. I wasn't with them all that long, but we played some marvelous shows. We opened for Heart a few times, and that was marvelous. We played a Speedway in Boston for 30,000 people, a 60s review.
Do you remember who you played with besides Steppenwolf?
We had the James Gang. And I forget the others now. It's been too long.
So Joe Walsh was in the James Gang at the time?
Yes.
You got to meet.
No, he was not in the James Gang. I had played with them earlier when he was with them. He did not play the Speedway. I have to correct that.
So you really have met this incredible group of great musicians. I mean, a lot of them who are alive, still working today.
Yeah.
Of course, Joe Walsh is in the Eagles. I read after Steppenwolf, you toured with Hoyt Axton.
Yes, I played bass for him. And it's funny because he wrote The Pusher.
Yes, for Steppenwolf.
And he wrote Snowblind Friend, which was a hit off Steppenwolf 7.
When I was looking at your biography, you mentioned that his mother wrote one of the Elvis Presley hits, which...
Heartbreak Hotel.
Heartbreak Hotel. Yeah, so what? It must be in the genes, the Axtons.
And Hoyt played the dad in Gremlins.
Kind of like you, with a theater background. He was an actor and a musician.
Yes.
Now, that takes us up to 1979, and I read that you stopped working as a touring musician there because you wanted to get married, and the woman you wanted to marry didn't want to marry a touring musician, so you stopped at least for that time, and you moved to Maui.
Yeah.
So you're now about 29, and you went from playing music to being a DJ on the radio in Hawaii?
I was retired for a little while. I didn't work at all. And it was boring as hell. And I had given up playing. I still had two guitars and two basses. And I had my Hammond B3 organ, which I carried around most of my life. So I called on this radio station to try and sell them a printing service that my father-in-law, he ran a printing company. And I worked for them for a little while selling printing. And I called on the radio station, and the program director took me back into the studio and said, "Does any of this look familiar to you? Do you understand what we're doing here?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I've been in studios all my life. That's an Ampex 351 tape recorder. Those are Technics 1200 turntables, you know, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "Well, we need a weekend DJ."
Boy, you were at the right time and place.
Yeah. So I was trying to sell them, and they were trying to sell me. So I hired on and did Saturday and Sunday nights, got freeform album play. I mean, I could play anything I wanted. And on Sunday nights, I'd play my classic album replay of the week. And I'd play a whole album, like Who's Next? Both sides, top to bottom.
Did you play some Hawaiian music? Because, you know,
yes. And this station was a country station during the week. It was a split format, and it was floundering in the market. I got the morning job 3 months later. They hired me to take over the morning show from the weekends. And I introduced Hawaiian music with the country. And all of a sudden, the ratings shot up and the advertising shot up. So then a couple of years later, I got hired away by the number two station in the market and did the morning show there, got hired away to build another radio station, and ended up at Ka'oi Radio in the late 80s in Maui. All freeform radio except for one station was programmed. And it was a wonderful time. I did the morning show for 9 years, and I was able to play what I wanted, construct my sets the way I wanted to. It was just beautiful.
That seems like paradise, living on Maui and having this a popular morning show and being able to play whatever you want.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Now, when we talked before, I testing out the audio, I mentioned to you how much I love Jawaian music, which is a blend of Jamaican reggae, Hawaiian pop, and some Motown in there too. And you told me you were kind of there at the birth of Jawaian. Can you tell us that story?
We were recording in my little Maui studio next to Bounty Music on Derry Road. It was a very small studio. And I was recording a fellow who was playing straight up reggae most of the time, but he also played Hawaiian music. And for one of these songs, we brought in a drummer and bass player that played reggae music and recorded this Hawaiian song with a reggae bottom. And Marty Dredd, the fellow that was there, hollered out, "Man, that's Jawaian music."
And that was the first time you heard that term?
Yes, I'd never heard it before.
It's so good. It's such a perfect term.
Yeah.
And did you then go on to record some what would be considered Jawaian records?
No, that was the only one I did. I did traditional Hawaiian music. I had a record label called Maui Zone Records and Tapes. And I had 26 albums out on that label.
Were there any artists that I might know? I mean, I know Iz as maybe the most famous Hawaiian musician.
I mixed him live, but I never recorded him.
And of course, he's famous for Somewhere Over the Rainbow, but other things. But you weren't doing things like Don Ho. You were doing a kind of musicians do a little more interesting, I guess. Don Ho.
It wasn't schlocky music at all.
I was trying to avoid the term schlocky, but that's what I was thinking.
No, these were Maui artists playing genuine Hawaiian music, and they couldn't get airplay and they couldn't get into the big hotels. That was all dominated by Oahu, Honolulu artists.
And that's the Don Ho's of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And his descendants.
You were able to break some of these Maui artists then by playing them on the radio?
Yes.
Wow. That's like paying it forward, John. Kind of like what the Detroit station did for the Ascots back in 65.
I never thought of it that way.
Now, we're still on Hawaii, and you built your own professional recording studio. Was that when you met Walter Becker of Steely Dan? I know you worked with him, and also at least on one record with Donald Fagen on his Kamakiriad solo album.
Yes, I did both of their solo albums. Walter walked into my little Hawaiian studio one day, and he wanted to listen. He had a pickup truck full of tapes, and he wanted to listen to all these Steely Dan outtakes and alternate mixes. And so we got Donald Fagen on the phone for 5 days, and we played all these things for him and Walter. And then I made 2 DAT tapes. Remember those?
Yes, it's kind of a legacy medium now. Yeah. And legacy is a nice way of saying obsolete, I guess.
Yeah. So I made 2 DAT tapes of the songs that they wanted to keep. And then Walter and Donald told me to go out to the dumpster and cut up all the tapes and throw them away.
Did you do that?
It took me a few days, but I did it.
Wow. What a shame.
I know. I destroyed all the outtakes of Steely Dan.
Ah. Did they ever come back and say, boy, I wish you hadn't done that?
No.
They never regretted it.
Both said, we released the good stuff. So Walter came back into the studio a few weeks later, and he said, are you making any money here? And I said, yeah, I'm feeding the label, and I'm doing some other independent projects, and I'm making a living. And he says, well, why don't we close this down and go build a real studio? And I said, well, I've got 5 albums in production for my label. I need 90 days. So he said, fine, but let's go start looking at property. So all of a sudden, Walter and I'd known him since 82. This was 1989. So all of a sudden, Walter and I are looking at property for a multi-million dollar recording studio. That changed my life. We finally settled on 7 acres in Ulupalakua, where his wife owned land. And there was a small redwood house on the property, which we turned into the control room. And then we hired a Los Angeles architect firm to design the playing room, which we built 35 feet away. I had conduits with all the wiring going back and forth between the 2 buildings underground. Yeah, and then we had video links between the control room and the playing room. And my first client there was Willie Nelson.
Who has a home on Maui, doesn't he?
Yeah. When the IRS seized everything, they exempted one house, and he kept his Maui house. And so he was living there full-time, off the road, trying to deal with this $16 million problem. And we recorded some of his greatest hits over again, and he sold it on late night TV as not available in stores.
Right. But you must act now.
Yeah. And wait, there's more. And so we did that for him to sell to raise money for his tax bill. And we did this other song. It's kind of a war protest called Jimmy's Road, which you can find out on YouTube, I think. And it was just a marvelous thing. His guitar was seized, so I loaned him my Martin D-41, and he used it on the record. And then he kept it for months till he got his guitar back. And when he brought the guitar back to me, he says, "John, I've got to give you something for it. It's a really nice guitar, and I had it a long time." And I whipped out a Sharpie, and I said, "Start my trigger." So he signed my guitar.
That's all you asked, huh? Just sign the guitar?
Yeah. I still have it.
Oh, that's a nice story.
So, but then we started on Kamakuriad.
That was done at your studio on Maui?
Yes. All the rhythm tracking except for one song, and most of the vocals except for one song were all recorded there. Christopher Parker from the Saturday Night Live band came out and played drums, and we just had a wonderful set of sessions. It was many takes. Donald wrote out the drum parts so that Christopher had to play what was written, and then ad lib on turnarounds and things like that, but nevertheless, the beat was prescribed. Donald shipped his Rhodes piano over from New York. I didn't have a Rhodes piano tuner on Maui, so I had to hire a guy from Honolulu to fly in and tune Donald's piano once a week. We spent 2 years tracking that album almost.
Did you get producer credits on that, or was that Donald Fagen got producer credit?
No, Walter is the producer.
Oh, okay.
Roger Nichols is the chief engineer of record. I'm the second engineer.
Did you play on that at all, John?
No. Some of my instruments were used, that my Hammond organ was used, but I didn't play on it.
Was the guitar player Walter on Kamakuriad?
For some of it, also Dean Parks, a Los Angeles studio musician of great renown.
Yeah, I would imagine Steely Dan always got the best musicians, the best session guys. So now you've got your own studio there with Walter Becker on Maui, and at a certain point, I think you sold the whole thing to him or your share, and then you got into film production. Was that with David Lynch right away, and how did that come about?
Well, we got busted for a zoning violation in Maui, and Walter bought me out. I had an interest in the studio, and he bought me out. So I stuck around Maui for almost another year, but went back into radio, not on the air, but servicing radio stations, because I have a broadcast engineer's license. But then I was bored, so I moved back to the mainland, and I got my son in better schools. He was having trouble in the Maui schools.
As kind of an outsider, I've heard that can happen. they call us Haoles?
Haoles.
Haoles, okay.
Even though my son was born and raised there, he was still a Haole. So I moved back to the mainland. I moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and built a big studio there with what Walter had paid me for my interest in the other one. And it failed. And I used the same architect. Well, the architecture firm decided that they wanted to offer turnkey studios to their clients. So they wanted a technical designer on board and a start a new division of the company to equip the studios that they were building all over the world. And they asked me to form that division. So I moved to Los Angeles in 1995 and went to work equipping studios and procuring vintage equipment, things like that. David Lynch was a client of the architecture firm. They were designing his studio. And he signed a contract with me to specify, procure, and install all the gear, about $1 million worth of gear.
And this was a film studio that he was building?
Music, film, and effects. It was one studio that had to do all three. So we built a 22-foot screen with big JBL cinema speakers behind it and a $300,000 Euphonics console and all kinds of gear. And a lot of people don't realize it, but David Lynch shoots commercials. He does commercials about two or four a year, and his fees for that float his entire operation.
So they pay for the movies.
They pay for him to do whatever he wants to do. So he had shot a Honda Passport commercial in early 97. And he asked me to mix it. He says, "You're an engineer, right?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, I want to mix this in my own studio." And we weren't done installing the gear yet. It was really a kludge to be able to do this. So I mixed the Honda commercial. And it was a very successful commercial, ran for the entire model year, which normally they only run 10 or 12 weeks.
And he's getting residuals, right, for each time they run it.
Yeah, plus the big fee for making it. So a week later, he says, "You're the only one that knows how this studio works. You're going to have to run it." And I said, "Gee, Dave, I can't afford the pay cut." So he made an offer that was about 60% of what I was currently earning. And I turned it down and I counteroffered to about 85% of what I was currently earning. And we came into the middle there. But we set up a unique structure. When we worked on commercials, my pay doubled. When we worked on a film, my pay tripled. So, and if I wrote anything that ended up in one of his projects, I got publishing, royalties, etc. And so we made a deal. I went to work for him. We made an album called Lux Vivens for Jocelyn Montgomery, which was a beautiful record. And then we got into The Straight Story, the film.
And that was the first film you worked on with him?
Yes. I recorded the score. I did the temp music for it myself, and two pieces of my music stayed in the film.
Ah, and that, I think that was 1999 was released.
Was. Uh-huh. Yes, it was. And then we went right from there into the pilot for Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive was supposed to be an ABC television series.
That's kind of funny looking back on it, and then it became a film. What happened to the TV show? They thought it was a little too weird for a popular audience, or what?
During the course of making the pilot, ABC was sold to Disney.
That explains it.
That did explain it. All of a sudden, we were dealing with Disney people and they hated Mulholland Drive.
Two very different kind of film personalities.
Yeah. And yet Disney had distributed The Straight Story. They didn't make it, but they distributed it.
Well, of course, that actually was a kind of a different David Lynch type movie than Mulholland Drive.
Oh, yeah.
You had a story to it. I remember it was an old guy on a tractor, basically,
yeah.
driving the whole time. So it was kind of heartwarming. You know, it had the Disney criteria where Mulholland Drive was a little stranger.
Oh, yeah, very stranger. So the pilot was rejected. We went on hiatus. David and I worked on our album for months. And then Studio Canal, the French film production company, stepped up and said, look, you've got this unfinished project. They had seen the pilot, so they knew the quality of what we were shooting. And they said, let's make a feature film out of it. We'll finance it. And David said, I don't know how to do that. And so it languished for months more. And then...
Oh, he didn't know. He knew how to make a film, of course, but he didn't know how to continue on with Mulholland Drive in particular.
He didn't know how to wrap it up.
Oh, okay.
And make it one story. Because originally Mulholland Drive, the pilot was spinning a dozen threads.
So it can keep going as a TV show.
Yes. So Mulholland Drive as a feature film, that was a problem. But one Friday night after meditation, David calls me up from his office on the phone in the studio and said, call Gay. That's his assistant, Gay Pope. He said, call Gay. She's got to work this weekend. I've got an idea. So he sits in his chair and smokes and dictates the dialogue and the camera angles and all that sort of stuff. And she would type it into the computer. He couldn't write on the computer because the operation of actually typing interrupted his thought process. So over the weekend, he wrote the whole ending for Mulholland Drive.
That's some genius.
Yeah. Monday morning, he called the French and said, okay, I've got it. Let's do it.
And that's why we have this great movie today.
Yeah, and it turned into one of the most beloved films of the 21st century.
And I know, John, we talked about some of your classical influences. You got a chance to use some of those in the music you did for some of the David Lynch movies, didn't you? And some of your recording projects with him, these separate albums.
Well, I have four pieces of music in Mulholland Drive that David and I wrote together. I have two pieces in The Straight Story that I wrote. That's my total music involvement in his films until Twin Peaks, The Return. I have music in that. That was 2017.
Of course, that music, though, is very different than So Good, the 45.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't garage rock by any means. You know, when you were talking about all the engineering you did and building these sound studios, the production studios, I remember reading, you said if you didn't pick up the guitar when you did, you think you might have had a career in science and you had a chemistry set that you were quite attached to as a kid. But it seems to me, looking back on your career, you were able to combine them both, the science and the technology with the music.
I was. And my last studio here in Portland was called The Lab.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So how'd you get from Los Angeles and David Lynch to Portland?
Via Marin County. I left Lynch in December of 05. I had bought in late 03 and early 04, I had bought 20 acres in Marin County across from Skywalker Ranch on a ridge.
Oh my, what a location.
It was beautiful. And it was to be my home and studio. I was going to build my own movie mixing studio. And I bought a console and put it in storage and did the design, and we started construction. And 90 days after we broke ground, the banking crash happened. And our mortgage company went out of business. So I didn't have a takeout mortgage for the construction loan. And I should have just stopped construction and walked away. But nope. I finished it. I put $3 million in it, and it got foreclosed on. I lost the property, And my kids decided that they live here in Portland. And my kids decided Dad was going to live in Portland. So they moved me up here because I had nothing at that point after I lost the property.
And about what time was that? What year?
2011 was the final foreclosure. It's the problem started in the end of 2008.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I had friends who got laid off. It was bad economic times.
Yes, it was. So they moved me. I still had all my gear and instruments, but I didn't have a place for anything. Everything was in storage now. So my kids moved me up here, and I spent the first year with my son and his lady friend in a spare bedroom in their house while I got established. And I put my gear in an empty room in Sonic Media Studios at 19th and Lovejoy in Portland. I started working on commercials and on Grimm.
Oh, yes, the TV show that was filmed here.
Yeah, Sonic Media did the ADR recording, the dialogue replacement recording. So I did some of that. And I was an extra in two episodes, too. I played an old homeless guy.
So you got to use some of the acting. You started in back in school, huh?
Yep.
When you were in shows.
Yeah. So I got my start there. And then the Interstate and Alberta property opened up in 2013. And I got a royalty check in from Krista Bell for a song we had written called This Train. I took that royalty check and went into business. I leased the place. I got all my equipment out of storage and started setting it all up. And I immediately went to work mixing films. I still had boxes and stuff strewn all around the studio, but the control room was up and running. And I had a 5.1 mixing system. I immediately went into film work as soon as I opened the door.
Is that when you did some of the David Lynch DVDs when they were remixed in 5.1?
I did those at David Lynch's in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Oh, okay. So you already had the expertise.
Yes. In the end, I mixed 24 feature films, 15 shorts, and over 400 records.
Were there any that stand out for you? A movie, a record?
There's a movie that we did here for director John Garcia. He did three movies called The Falls. There were three different installments. I mixed two of those films. And the first one I mixed, called The Falls, Testament of Love, we had members of the Oregon Symphony and Portland Cello Project on the score. We scored the movie. It was just beautiful. That really stands out. And it was sold and distributed, and John did well with it.
The musicians came into your studio, the lab, to do the recording?
Yeah.
Well, you must have had an incredible setup.
It was a good setup. I had 2,500 square feet.
And you recently, after building all this, which is amazing, you recently sold it and went into what you're calling retirement, air quotes.
Yeah. I retired May 1st, and it took 3 months to sell off everything in the studio. So it wasn't till August 1st that I turned in the keys. And I was still paying that big rent. But I did sell off everything, even the acoustic treatments on the walls. Everything went.
Nobody took over the studio then. It was just sold entirely, the inventory?
That's correct. It's being turned into office space.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the studio is gone. It was fun, though. I was in there a little over 8 years.
Now, you've also continued to be a musician in Portland. You mentioned, again, when we talked before, that you've played bass in a Portland band called Christy Joseph and The Purpose. The music just seems to be in your blood. You can't really retire from it, can you?
No. And I'm negotiating on producing an album right now in another studio.
Oh, is that for Christy Joseph and The Purpose?
No, it's for another independent Portland artist.
Ah. Is that a name you wanted to keep secret for the time being? Or?
Yeah, until we've actually got a deal.
Okay, that's fair enough. Well, John, one last question. It's my attempt to tie everything together with this question. In a previous interview, you said film and recording is a wonderful thing, but the guitar was the key to it all for you. And you got your first guitar at age 10, growing up in Pontiac, Michigan. Here we are, over 60 years later. You're still in love with the instrument. I wanted to ask, what was the first guitar? And I read on Facebook, because I'm following your post, what was your most recent acquisition, which you said was somewhat of a dream instrument for you, a dream guitar?
When I was young, my bass player's father had a 1952 gold top Les Paul and a Gibson Les Paul amplifier. He'd let me play it a few times, not with the band, but just at his house. I fell in love with it. I've wanted a gold top Les Paul ever since. Throughout the years, Les Pauls have been modified and they don't sound like they did in the old days. And Gibson just released a 1950s vintage Gibson Les Paul gold top. So I couldn't resist it. I bought it.
Did it bring back memories of being in your bandmate's house and playing his father's guitar?
The first song I played on it was Johnny B. Good.
It must sound really good on a Gibson gold top from the 50s, huh?
Yeah, through a nice little old Fender practice amp.
Well, I really appreciate your time on this, John. And my challenge was kind of distilling this incredible, long, productive, like I said, fascinating career down into a few minutes of interview, anywhere from, we'll cut it down to half hour for broadcast and run the longer version on the web. But I want to thank you so much for being with us here today, coming out of retirement, if only briefly, to do the show.
Thank you so much, Ken. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you can listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, John Neff, who recently retired from a very long, productive, and fascinating career in music and recording, a career that included writing and recording a 60s garage rock classic, opening for the Turtles and the Who, playing guitar in soul music producer Don Davis's house band, touring on bass with Steppenwolf and Hoyt Axton, DJing on Maui Radio, engineering on solo albums for Steely Dan's Walter Becker and Donald Fagen, and collaborating on sound design with filmmaker David Lynch. You can find out more about John on his website, johnneffproductions.com. KBOO, by the way, is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Just a note that Jonesy comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, January 20th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, rock on, Ascots! You did, honey. Now watch go through this big field.